If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. What was life like in the kingdoms of Wales during the Middle Ages? What happened when the Normans arrived? And what became of Owain Glyndŵr's rebellion? These are just some of the questions covered in today's Everything You Wanted to Know episode, as we delve headfirst into medieval Wales. Our expert for today's episode is Swansea University's Matthew Stevens, and putting the questions to Matthew is our acting digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
In today's Everything You Wanted to Know About episode, we're going to be considering the history of medieval Wales, which we'll loosely cover between the early medieval period and the reign of Henry VIII, though we do have some questions there that might take us outside of that remit a little bit today, and we're going to see where the conversation goes around this very big topic. As always, it is a big topic, and our expert today is going to be tackling popular search queries as well as some listener questions. I'm really pleased to welcome Dr. Matthew Stevens, who is Associate Professor of History at the University of Swansea, and whose specialties include medieval Welsh history and medieval colonisation. Thanks for joining us, Matthew.
Thank you.
So to start us off, perhaps we can look at what the nation that's now Wales looked like in the early medieval period, as perhaps a very brief look at what happened after the departure of Roman forces and what that means for the development of the Welsh kingdoms.
Well, Wales looks as much like anything like a checkerboard in the early Middle Ages. The idea of Wales as one nation is really something that comes about sort of later, you know, hundreds of years after the Romans have departed, really. I think everybody in the Middle Ages who fancies himself a king has an image of possessing everything they see. But in reality, it was only by the, say, 700s, so 300 years after the Romans left, that all of Wales fit into one of probably four or five reasonably substantial kingdoms that made up Wales by then.
So in what sort of regions were these kingdoms developing and under whose leadership?
Well, it's really a matter of kind of what local kings, or really in our minds, probably the better analogy would be local warlords. So if we go around Wales in a clockwise direction, if we start in Snowdonia in the northwest, the kingdom of Gwynedd emerges. If we move to about 2 o'clock on the clock, we get to the kingdom of Powys. And then in the southeast, we have Morgannwg, and in the southwest, we have Deheubarth. And those are the four principal kingdoms that get rolling by the what we would call the earlier dark Middle Ages in Wales. So there's some kind of chaos after the Romans leave, and there's some people come from Ireland, and nobody quite knows who's in charge. But by the time we get to the year 700-800, those four kingdoms make up most of the population of Wales. They cover most people.
So where do these kingdoms sit then with Christianity? When had Christianity come to Wales, and how is it, where does it sit in these kingdoms?
Well, Christianity probably came to Wales together with the Roman legions, this is the same way it came to the rest of Britain. We have to remember that there are three major permanent Roman outposts in Roman Britain. And one of those three is in Caerleon in southeast Wales. And it probably had about 5,000 troops there at any one time. Plus, in addition to troops, there are lots of other sort of sundry people, wives, camp followers, other people who would have come to Wales from around the Roman Empire. And those people would have brought Christianity with them. If we think about Wales as a whole, in the Roman period, there were probably only about 100,000 people in all of Wales. So those 5,000 people in Caerleon made up about 120 of all people in Wales. And we know that there were Christians among them for a variety of reasons, but one of the most sort of solid pieces of evidence we have is that the only two Christian martyrs we know of from Roman Britain were in Caerleon, two chaps named Julius and Aaron, who were probably martyred around about the year 300 in one of these moments when the kind of Christianizing Roman Empire sort of pushes back against Christianity. You have to remember the kind of Roman empires fancied themselves to be worshipped as gods, plus as a kind of older Roman pantheon. And so Christianity sort of challenged that time and again before it eventually is adopted as the religion of the empire.
Okay. If I can ask about the differences in these four kingdoms that you've already mentioned, how different or disparate would someone's lives have been in, for instance, Gwynedd and Powys? How different would they have been, or would it have been quite similar?
Well, out of the four, the two in the west are very much orientated towards the Irish Sea. So if you're in Snowdonia in the Kingdom of Gwynedd, or if you're in Deheubarth in the southwest, most people thought of the kind of the bigger world as being across the Irish Sea. And there's lots of trade and movement of people around the Irish Sea. Of course, St. Patrick spends some time in Wales before he goes back to Ireland to convert the island to Christianity. And that's kind of representative of how their world worked. Whereas if you were in Powys in the east, you would have been looking towards England. There's this very old history in Powys of the early medieval kingdom of Powys thinking of Shrewsbury as its center. Now, in our mind, that's firmly just on the English side of the border now. But right in the late Middle Ages, the kings of Powys were looking east, thinking, oh, if only we could get east of the Severn again. And it's a bit the same in southeast Wales, that they would have looked east across the Severn to their connections for trade and immigration.
And in terms of any sort of sense of different identity, there's obviously that you mentioned just there, but did that lead to any sort of conflict between these kingdoms? What sort of power struggles might have been happening there?
Yeah, these kingdoms didn't really think of themselves as having a whole lot in common. You know, today we, in our mind, we think of Wales as one nation. And so, of course, we kind of project that back into the past. But for people living them, They weren't very friendly neighbors with one another. I think Professor David Stevenson had a look at the Kingdom of Powys, which for practical terms was based around where Welshpool is now. And Powys was at war, an armed conflict with the Kingdom of Gwynedd, something like 11 or 12 times across the late 1100s and early 1200s. And these small kingdoms really tried to not so much conquer their neighbors by taking their territory, but kind of go over and raid and brutalize their neighbors to the point where the neighboring kingdom would go, all right, we put our hands up, you know, you can tell us what to do, you can be in charge.
Okay, not very friendly. We've got a question here, and I don't know if this is the appropriate place to put this question, but we've got a question here from a listener called Ella Tay. Thanks, Ella, about the laws of Hywel-dda. I wonder if we could talk about those and what that meant.
Yeah, the laws of Hywel-dda are really interesting because they you know, they represent a vision of Wales as a single place. So at the same time that I've been saying, look, you know, these are little kingdoms struggling against each other all the time, the king of Deheubarth in the southwest, you know, who we now know as Howel the Good, he supposedly, after asserting control over most of Wales as a kind of warlord, he makes friends with the English king Athelstan. He goes on pilgrimage to Rome. You know, he tries to really put himself out there as a sort of something, not exactly a national leader, but closer to it maybe than we'd seen before. Keep in mind, he never has all of Wales under his thumb. But he comes home and he invites delegates from all different parts of Wales to come and try and sort of compile Welsh law. Because at this time, law was very much whatever the local custom was, you know. And that could be anything about how you decide which farmer owns a field, how do you work it out when person A owes person B some money, and so forth. And we don't really have a record of what happened when this gathering took place. But from that time, lawyers, who much like today are their own kind of little tribe or cult, they start to put together, you know, a customary law for Wales. And it sort of over the following hundreds of years, between the time of Hywel Dda back, you know, in the late 800s up to the 1100s, over that really long time, it becomes the kind of accepted law of the land. And we start to get written texts of it. And we have today a surprising number of these little law handbooks that lawyers carried around in the Middle Ages. And so the law of Hywel Dda, it really sort of sows the seeds that a few hundred years later would come to fruition as a kind of idea of a national identity or something we could all hang our hat on in Wales.
And what are some other, or who are rather, some other leaders who then take up this mantle of the idea of these kingdoms coming together?
Well, we kind of have a round robin affair where in Gwynedd in the northwest, we have a king called Owen Gwynedd, who tries to project his power over most of Wales. And then we have a bit when the princes of Powys come in the 12th century. And then finally, at the end of the 12th century, we get a chap in southwest Wales in the kingdom of Deheubarth called the Lord Rhys. And he's probably the most successful or has the longest impact up until the end of the 1100s because he has a really concerted program of building parish churches. Wales is getting infrastructure for the first time, really, in the 1100s, and we see bridges being built and little stone churches popping up everywhere. And it's a kind of huge, we might even say a kind of huge European project in the 1100s to make sure every man, woman, and child can walk to a parish church on a Sunday. And that's a big ask if you think about kind of the remote, mountainous nature of lots of parts of Wales. And the Lord Rhys in southwest Wales, that's his contribution to what we might now read back as a national project. So if Hywel Dda kicked off this movement toward the law, the Lord Rhys kicks off this big push to make sure we all have a parish church. And there is a kind of momentum there.
Right. Well, we're in the 11th century there then. And obviously something pretty big happens to Britain in the 11th century as well, in terms of the Norman invasion. And what does this mean for, I'm going to say Wales, as you know, I know that term isn't necessarily relevant at this stage.
Yeah, historians are often asked or kind of coached to say things like, bombastic things like, it had changed everything. But when it comes to the Norman conquest in England, the kind of spillover impact of that on Wales, it really did change everything in the sense that up until then, kind of Welsh politics is very much about these little kingdoms, these little groups, you know, fighting against each other. And they're quite happy to kind of welcome in maybe some mercenaries from Ireland or maybe some fighters from Scotland or maybe even to draft in some help from across the English border in their own affairs. But these chaps turn up from the outside. And the first Normans come into Wales in 1067, and they set up what are now Chepstow and Monmouth, two fortifications and two towns on the west side of the border that would be there permanently. And the fact that these chaps come in and they don't just participate in this system of fighting and then leave again, but rather they stay, that starts the ball rolling in a completely different direction. And as the Normans come, they conquer areas of land. They tend to push the Welsh people out in the upland areas, and they take the best lowland farmland and they give it to people they bring in from England to farm it. They're the first people to really circulate coins in large numbers in Wales for the purpose of being able to collect those coins back in taxes. In order to make that possible, they set up regular markets and fairs where farmers are expected to sell their produce. All of this changes the landscape in a really durable, permanent way. And it starts in southeast Wales and stretches along the south coast of Wales. The first conquered places are, of course, around, you know, sort of the Gower out through Pembroke, Glamorgan, of course. And it creates a two-tier society where we have a kind of native Wales in the northwest and a conquered Wales in the south and east, where there are these kind of almost segregation type divisions between upland Welshries and lowland Englishries, as they would be called. And there's a quite a modern economy. And then there's a kind of economically, I'm trying to avoid this word backward, but really quite an economically backward north and west in Wales. And all of that really starts with the arrival of the Normans.
And is there any pushback or what sort of resistance comes from the native people in Wales?
Well, at first, the Welsh are pretty divided, really. Probably the only man who could reasonably have called himself king of all Wales, Gruffydd ap Llywelyn, he dies in 1063. So if you sort of check your calendar, that's only 4 years before the Normans first arrive in Wales. And so things are in a really kind of chaotic state. Meanwhile, this big Norman war machine, which has just conquered England, is on the move and it's pressing into South Wales. And so it's really only when King Stephen comes to the throne in England and you see a big civil war erupt in England that finally Wales gets a breather. And so that's 100 years down the road, basically. And, you know, it's at this time that the Welsh push back a little and we see a kind of balance reached. I mean, really, by the time we get to the mid-1100s, we have a reasonable balance of power between Welsh and Normans or English in Wales. And that's going to develop a little bit, more or less stay the same until we get the next big wave of conquest in the 1200s, the conquest as we know it now, you know, under Edward I.
Yes, right. Well, I would like to get onto that in a little while, but I wonder if we can dip out of that timeline just briefly to address another listener question. We've got one here from Jeff Tobin, who has asked, was Geoffrey of Monmouth real, or was he, as Francis Uriah Locke claims, a pseudonym of Henry of Blois?
Okay, this is really specific, and this is something that if you're sort of into medieval Welsh history, you've probably taken note of in the last few years, because Francis Lott has made a big stir, this chap with some claims saying, you know, you all think that Godfrey of Monmouth, you know, is basically from the March of Wales, that he's a Welshman, and you know, that Wales has a claim to him, as it were, but really he's a Frenchman from Normandy, and Godfrey of Monmouth, you probably know already, I'm sure, but he's the author of the History of the Kings of Britain, from which we get eventually all these stories about Arthur and Camelot and the whole Arthurian legend as we know it now, right? So he kind of originates that stuff out of kind of Welsh legend, together with sort of ideas of chivalry and society as they were in the 1100s. Now, I would say this. We all love a good conspiracy theory. However, Godfrey of Monmouth really was a real guy. The contention here is that Godfrey of Monmouth, as we know him, a chap who became a Benedictine monk in Monmouth and then spent most of his life thereafter knocking around Oxford, where he witnesses various sort of property deeds and things like this. The conspiracy theory goes, that's just a pseudonym for this other chap, Henry of Blois, who was born in Normandy. Henry had been the grandson of William the Conqueror, and he was at Glastonbury Abbey. And if you believe this Francis Lott chap, he says, this aristocratic Henry of Blois, he actually wrote the Arthurian legends, and then he used this Godfrey of Monmouth pseudonym. What I would say about that is, you might use a pseudonym to write the book, but it's a bit of a strange thing to also use a pseudonym when you're witnessing your neighbor's property deeds in Oxford over the course of 10 or 12 years. So I think that's about as far as that discussion needs to go. And I think despite this kind of intellectual challenge, I think we could still claim Godfrey of Monmouth as sort of one of our own.
Wonderful. Okay, great answer. Thank you. So if we go back then to this sort of two-tier society that you've mentioned, perseveres into the 1200s. We have a question here about the Treaty of Montgomery, which, correct me if I'm wrong, this is Llywelyn the Great and Henry the Third. Is that correct?
It's Llywelyn the Last and Henry the Third.
Llywelyn the Last and Henry the Third. What can you tell our listeners about that?
Okay. So if we have the emergence in the 1100s of a kind of two-tier system, a kind of colonized South and East Wales that's under foreign control and a native-ruled North and West, well, there's no formal relationship between the two sides there. For example, back in the reign of King John, when Magna Carta was wrote up, a line had gone in there to say, well, in addition to all these things we're worried about in England, we just want to include here a mention that in Welsh areas, things ought to be sorted out by Welsh methods. And in the March of Wales, this kind of conquered borderland, they ought to be sorted out by the custom and the march. And so you can see there the emergence formally of the existence of this two-tier system. The problem is acknowledging it exists doesn't actually set any lines around it. You know, who exactly should control whom or be lord over whom or get the tax money from whom? And so Llywelyn ap Gruffydd, Llywelyn the Last, as he were, takes advantage of the next big civil war in England. When Henry III is fighting against his own barons in England, Llywelyn, who's based in Gwynedd in 1067, he goes to the king and he says, look, I am willing to recognize we've got this two-tier society, but what I want from you is to put it down in writing exactly how far my control as Prince of Wales ought to go. And because Henry's up against it and he could really use some cash, and Llywelyn agrees to pay quite a lot of money, they go for it. And they write up this contract, and Llywelyn basically is given, and here's where it gets sticky, lordship over all of the Welsh lords of Wales. In exchange for that, he has to pay 25,000 marks. And it's hard to put that in modern money, but it would be the equivalent of Llywelyn had to come up with an amount of money that's equal to, I tried to work this out, about 2 weeks' wages for every single household in Wales every year for 10 years. And so it's an extraordinary amount of money he agrees to pay. And so he's paid all this cash, or he's promised to pay it anyway. And at first he's making the payments, although after a little bit, he feels the squeeze and he can't keep up the payments. And he thinks he's got a good deal, except when he comes to sort of claiming, quote, lordship over all the Welsh lords of Wales. Because if you remember when I said the creation of this two-tier society in the south and east of Wales, what it did was it pushed Welsh people up into these upland areas called Welshries, and it cleared the sort of lowland good farmland for English immigrants. I mean, that's unjust in itself. But so those Welsh people living in the uplands, who did they owe their allegiance to? Is it this new Prince of Wales, Llywelyn ap Gruffydd, or is it their local man who they've been paying taxes to? And so this is the sticking point of the Treaty of Montgomery. And that's what leads really famously to the construction of Caerphilly Castle, because down around Cardiff, of course, is in English hands, but just up at Caerphilly, that's far enough north, there's a lot of Welsh people living up there. And Llywelyn trundles down and says, ha, under this treaty, you now pay your taxes to me. And the lords of Glamorgan come out to Cardiff and go, nope, just not having that. And so they knock up Caerphilly Castle, which is a huge lump of a thing, in a big hurry to try and keep Llywelyn out. And this is kind of sums up the whole tension and disagreement that swirls around that treaty up until war breaks out between the English and the Welsh 10 years later.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense, yes. And before we do go into that war, that next step, I'd like to talk about another Llywelyn, because I did skip us ahead. So we've got Llywelyn ap Gruffydd, who is the last Welsh Prince of Wales, but we also have Llywelyn the Great. Who was he?
Okay, so if we back up, Llywelyn the Great is the grandfather of Llywelyn the Last. And we spent a lot of time talking about, quote unquote, Llywelyn the Last, because he is the last Prince of Wales. He's the man who gets this treaty that formally creates the principality in 1067. But in fact, he wasn't any more powerful than his grandfather had been 20 years before, Llywelyn ap Iorwerth, Llywelyn the Great. Now, Llywelyn the Great had kind of been on-again, off-again friends with Bad King John over in England. And he'd kind of manipulated his sort of sometimes friendly, sometimes unfriendly relationship to his best advantage. So, for example, he'd married Bad King John's illegitimate daughter, Joan, to kind of create a family tie there. That worked out for both of them, because under English law, children born out of wedlock didn't really have any formal rights. But under Welsh law, they didn't really care. And so from a Welsh perspective, it was a good match, you know, for Llywelyn. And from King John's point of view, he thought, well, I'm just marrying off my illegitimate daughter quietly to the side. But Llywelyn and John did have some kind of relationship. And Llywelyn went with John and brought Welsh troops to fight with John in Scotland, for example. And so he's really kind of upping his game and participating on the kind of bigger British scene. And it does go sour, and in the end, John does try and invade Wales, but he tries to take troops into North Wales, and they have terrible weather, and there's rainstorms. They don't get much further than the Lloydians, the Lloydian range, you know, and they have to turn back east again. And so Llywelyn the Great, he managed to play the game of politics, to really climb the greasy pole, and to create a political environment where the Kingdom of Gwynedd in Northwest Wales had enough power that his grandson could realistically create the Principality of Wales in 1267. And so he kind of laid all of the foundations that his grandson, Llywelyn the Last, turned into the, quote, Principality of Wales with the Treaty of Montgomery.
Okay, interesting stuff. And we've got a listener question here from someone called Adolgeith, who is asking about that sort of Gwynedd history. And they have asked, is the Gwynedd-centric narrative counterproductive to understanding medieval Welsh history?
Yes. Yes. I can give you a really good, solid answer on that. Yes. And that way of telling Welsh history comes from a man named J.E. Lloyd, who is really the kind of father of Welsh history as an academic discipline. So he lives in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and he writes a two-volume history of Wales published in 1911 called A History of Wales from the Earliest Times to the Edwardian Conquest. And this is part of this kind of Victorian movement towards nation building that you see all throughout the British Empire, you know, not just in Britain, but throughout the British Empire, you know, the different peoples that had been absorbed over the centuries in the British Empire starting to look at their own history, write their own history and say, no, we have a voice here too. And J.E. Lloyd, he is influential in all kinds of respects, helping to set up a kind of publication series for Welsh history, just really giving Welsh history academics a voice. But in his kind of striving to create a story of Wales, what he does is he reads it backwards and he says, okay, Llywelyn the Last and his grandfather Llywelyn the Great came closest of anybody to creating what we might call a kind of constitutional, legally made, you know, Welsh nation. And so let's read history back and say anyone who's against those fellows is a baddie and anybody who's with them is a goodie. And so, for example, everything becomes about the history of Gwynedd when the Kingdom of Powys right next door, as I said just a few minutes ago, of course, they were in armed conflict with Gwynedd again and again as the kings of Gwynedd tried to force their way in and nick parts of their territory and, you know, just generally make trouble for them. And so the sort of Lords of Powys have been seen as the sort of great baddies of Welsh history, and the Princess of Gwynedd as the goodies. But it's just not fair. It's just totally not on.
And so these sort of repositionings and revisions are happening at the moment. Have they happened recently? What's changing about Welsh history right now?
Yeah, I think we're going through a big period of kind of revisiting the way in which we've interpreted the history of Wales in the last 100 years. I mean, Lloyd has his place. Professor Hugh Price at Bangor University has recently written a really good biography of J. Lloyd and how he perceived history and how he taught it. And so that kind of examining the historians is going on one hand. And then on the other hand, Professor David Stevenson has recently, I think about 4 years ago, published a really good one-volume history of the Kingdom of Powys, which actually looks at the Kingdom of Powys from the point of view of the Princes of Powys. And if you start reading it from their point of view, then, of course, the Princess of Gwynedd were the baddies, you know, clearly all the time. All of this comes from us taking our modern idea of Wales as one nation and trying to force it back into the Middle Ages at a time when Wales was always comprised, in the eyes of Welsh people living then, of two or three or four kingdoms. You know, Wales as a nation, as we know it now, is really an idea of a political nation of Wales is an invention very much of the turn of the 19th to 20th century. And J.E. Lloyd's part of that story. I mean, socially, culturally, linguistically, Wales has always been what we would now recognize as a nation. But the idea of a political nation, you know, as a kind of government to the people, that's very much a kind of idea that we've been trying to push back into Wales for the last 100 years. It doesn't really work.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
We have a system that's emerged by the late 1300s in which most of the English landlords of Wales are absentee. And they treat their possessions in Wales, which are outside of the normal English legal framework, as this kind of special place where they can raise as much taxes as they want, as unscrupulously as they want, and they can go out there and fancy themselves king of a very small kingdom once or twice a year and have a big party, basically. And that's kind of where we're at.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Well, that's such interesting stuff. And I'm almost loath to move us back towards what we were talking about a few moments ago. And so you've taken us up to the Treaty of Montgomery, and sort of barely a few years later, there's another hugely significant shift in Wales's future. What happens with the conquest of Wales?
Well, the really short version is Llywelyn ap Gruffydd, he couldn't pay his bills. He just absolutely could not afford that treaty. if you imagine this chap saying to the people of the Principality of Wales, particularly the people of Gwynedd, all right, every household has to pay 2 weeks' income worth of taxes every year for the next 10 years, in addition to your regular tax burden. People don't want to pay. They find ways not to pay. And he just couldn't squeeze enough money out of his own people to pay the bills, basically. And then, he didn't want to pay them because, as demonstrated by, you know, Caerphilly Castle being knocked up sort of in his face to keep him away from trying to control upland Welsh, you know, outside of his home region, he didn't want to pay either. And so this leads to a big falling out between him and Henry III's successor, Edward I, Edward Longshanks, Edward Hammer of the Scots, you know, all of the nicknames that man has. And at first, Edward treats it like, as he puts it, when he pitches going to war against the Welsh in 1277, he says, we need to prosecute a war against, quote, a rebel baron and a disturber of the peace. That's where Edward's at in 1277. He's a kind of international playboy. He's just been on crusade. He stopped in France and made peace in a small civil war in Gascony on the way home. You know, he's really full of himself. And the idea that this chap up in his mountain in North Wales is giving him two fingers, it just drives him nuts. And so he goes to war. But something really radical happens after that, and something really dark, you know, I mean, maybe in my mind, the kind of darkest turn in pre-modern Welsh history, which is, okay, there's a war in 1277. After that, they make peace. Llywelyn is confined to just Snowdonia. Edward I invites him over to Worcester Cathedral, where he presides over Llywelyn's wedding. I mean, it's a real kind of diplomatic, international, through gritted teeth love-in. You know, the King of Scotland trundles down. You know, it's a big international affair. The problem is rebellion then breaks out again in 1282, 5 years later. And this time, Edward, whatever goodwill this very arrogant man had, is gone. And when he pitches it to his barons the second time around that they should stump up some taxes and raise an army and go into Wales, rather than referring to Llywelyn as a disturber of the peace, he says, no, we are on a mission to, quote, end the malice of Llywelyn and people of his race. And that plugs into all kind of cultural things that were happening across Europe at that time. What Geraldine Heng, a prominent American historian, has called, quote, the invention of racism in the Middle Ages. It's just this idea that was percolating to the top of European society that it really ought to be each to their own, and that we really are fundamentally different from other people who speak a different language or have different cultural habits. And so this is no longer political. This is, I hesitate to use the word racial, but in effect, that's what it is. You know, it's a second war that, yes, there's political and economic dimensions, but there's a really dark sort of racial dimension too.
Right. And how do these grudges and what's the intent there, and what does this lead towards on the actions of Edward I?
Well, it leads to creating a system throughout the, say, one-third or 40% of Wales that falls into the Crown's hands of legal discrimination. So Welsh and English people are separate under law. The Welsh pay higher taxes, particularly following a rebellion that comes in 1295, a few years down the road. Edward tightens these restrictions up even more. You know, Welshmen are not to hold public office. Welshmen are not to bear arms. You know, they can't carry arms. Welshmen are not to congregate in groups. A Welshman may not act as a witness in court against an Englishman. And it just goes on and on. And those regulations would hang around in various forms, some often ignored, but sometimes used against people, right up until 1536.
And this is the Statute of Rhislan, is that right? Well, I could be saying something.
Yeah, well, no, the ordinances against the Welsh, most of them are separate. They're in a separate document from 1295. But the Statute of Rhislan in Wales also recognises differences between English and Welsh. So the Statute of Rhislan is this document by which Edward creates his kind of legal settlement of Wales after conquest. He says, the principality will not become part of the English realm, but it shall remain the sort of private possession of the kings of England. And we're going to create our own mini legal system here. And it did have a lot of provisions in it, which the Welsh came to see as very much against them. For example, if you're a Welsh farmer, you could not legally sell your farm. Of course, you have a tax burden. You have to pay taxes on that land. But no matter how unprofitable you become, you cannot legally sell it. You could lease it to another person for 4 years at a time. And if you did that long enough, you could kind of by de facto sell it, because eventually people forget, you know, that it's only on lease. You're depending upon a system where people kind of forget in the long term that you've kind of quietly got out from under it. But the whole vision here is one where Welsh people are a kind of rural farming folk, right? And that they're not part of the kind of modern economic town-based English social system where people are buying and selling things and maybe they start a business and so forth. There is a little good in the Statute of Wales. It gave women a lot of rights they didn't have under Welsh law. Women could not own property separate from a man under Welsh law, but under the reformed law created by the Statute of Rutland, women, if they were a widow or if they didn't have any brothers, they could inherit or own or buy or sell property. And so there is some good to come out of it. But it, again, there's a dark side to that document.
Yes, how interesting. I had no idea about that element. That's really fascinating. We've had a lot of questions about castles of medieval Wales, and I guess this is probably the time to talk about it. We don't necessarily have a specific question, but can we talk a little bit about the development of those structures and what that meant for the landscape of Wales?
Okay, let's see. Where to begin with a kind of parachute into castles? So they're mostly symbolic most of the time, and that's really important to keep in mind. Most of them were originally lime-washed, which would have made them a kind of off-white. And don't think fairy tale exactly. I can't remember where it is, but in South Wales about 10 years ago, a small medieval tower was restored, and the decision was taken to lime-wash it to make it look realistic. It was period appropriate. Unfortunately, the lime wash got some bacteria in it. It turned to kind of off pink after a while. It was hideous. and that's kind of the vision of these castles that you should have in mind, you know. Not the kind of austere naked stone, but the hideous, slightly filthy looking lime washing with most of which had, of course, had toilets built into the castle. We'd go to a little bit of the tower that stuck maybe just, you know, 20 centimeters over the wall, and down it would fall. And so you can imagine the kind of brown streaks there. But these are all really practical. It's not what you might think of. You know, these are not big, beautiful structures, but they're really symbolic, you know, of the fact that, no, these are the new people in charge. And the most important uses of them were, this is where you went to pay your taxes. If you were called into local court for even the smallest of things, let's say if you had a booth and you were selling eggs and you started selling 20 minutes before the official start time of market, you'd get a fine. You know, these type of small things. And medieval people were really litigious. We reckon that the typical medieval peasant probably would have been in court maybe once a year, once every couple of years. Now, most of those are the equivalent of parking tickets. But that's probably more often than we would now pay a fine or a parking ticket, right? And all of that takes place in the castle. And so it's this constant interaction with this, you know, big, ugly building built by the outsider that creates a kind of psychological effect. And most of the time, that's the real function of the castle, right? Yes, there's military aspects. Every 20 years, there's a big rebellion, and you need to have that place of refuge to fight from, you know, to put viable things, to maybe keep people who come inside safe, you know, and so forth. But that's the minority of the time.
Okay, well, you mentioned rebellion or resistance there coming up quite a bit. And what is the sort of situation in sort of the late 13th century? And then I realise we're skipping us on a bit, but we've got a question here about the revolt of Owain Glyndŵr as well. So what's the situation for rebellion in Wales at this time?
Okay, well, there are two big rebellions in Wales. The first one comes in 1295. And so we're talking just over 10 years just over 10 years after the so-called final conquest of 1282-4. Now, that's a kind of nationally coordinated event. And if I remember right, I think the late Sir Rhys Davies called it a sort of general outcry against the injustice of English governance. So this is a real sort of grassroots rebellion. Now, it's led by a chap named Madog Ap Llywelyn from Anglesey, who has some connection with the old ruling house of Gwynedd. And it begins with taking the still under construction castle of Carnarvon by subterfuge, together with a bunch of uprisings around Wales. Now, the difficulty there is that King Edward I still in power, and he was just raising an army to go over to France and conduct a war there. And so he has lots of troops on hand, and he can immediately bring those forces to bear on Wales. He gets caught in Conway Castle throughout most of January 1295 in a very uncomfortable position because he had underestimated the opposition. But eventually, you know, spring comes, and in March, the Welsh defeated, soundly. And poor Madog Ap Llywelyn is taken down to the Tower of London, where he'd spend the rest of his life, up to 1312. And we kind of ask, well, why did that rebellion happen then? And the best connection people can make is that in 1292, 1293, Edward I was trying to collect the first national tax the English had imposed on Wales. And so a lot of the causes here are financial. You know, Wales is really, on a relative basis, it's poor. The towns that are created in Wales, they're pretty small. It's quite agricultural. It's not a place, you know, for example, Holland in the Middle Ages is quite wealthy because goods are coming in from the Holy Roman Empire in the east, and they're going out to England on the west. In Wales, goods aren't really traveling anywhere, just out to the village, that's it. Maybe Ireland at a stretch. And when the tax burden's ramped up, people go into rebellion. Of course, there are other senses of identity and maybe what we might connect with a burgeoning sense of nationhood involved there, but it's really, there's a big financial motivation. Glyndŵr, 100 years later, really different. Really different on a variety of levels. Probably by Glyndŵr, there is much more of a sense of this is about Welsh people as a people engaging in a rebellion against the English, you know, to a much greater degree.
And what are the motivating factors there beyond obviously the financial toll is it more the social segregation aspect of it?
Yeah, I should point out that after that 1295 rebellion, that's when you see the real ratcheting up of these sort of anti-Welsh race laws, right? Where the Welsh are paying higher taxes, they have limited rights and all these things. And those just stay there, burbling away in the background all the way up until Glyndŵr, you know, for another 100 years. And you find that the general economy of all of Europe and England and then Wales as well begins from the early 1390s to head into what we would call a pan-European economic depression. So again, there's a kind of financial side. On top of this, we have a system that's emerged by the late 1300s in which most of the English landlords of Wales are absentee. And they treat their possessions in Wales, which are outside of the normal English legal framework, as this kind of special place where they can raise as much taxes as they want, as unscrupulously as they want, and they can go out there and fancy themselves king of a very small kingdom once or twice a year and have a big party, basically. And that's kind of where we're at. And so the kind of rampant mismanagement of estates in Wales just accumulate over time. And you have this situation where what you find is that the amount of money going into the coffers of these absentee landowners is lower and lower, despite the fact that the tax rates are higher and higher. And so there's a real obvious level of corruption in the middle there. And it's this kind of long-term, just drip, drip, drip of things. For example, we have a marriage tax in England in the Middle Ages, right? And it's a kind of village affair, and you pay a few pence, right? In Wales, you have a thing called a mobair, which originally was a marriage tax, sometimes crudely called a virginity tax, stereotype being that you're a virgin until you're married. And that existed under Welsh law. It was paid once. When you get married, the money goes off to the prince. That's it, right? But for example, that law is taken and kind of twisted by the kind of new English overlords. And they say, okay, so this is something that only Welsh people pay. Well, let's have them pay that not only when they get married, but let's have them pay that at every time we have a substantiated accusation of sex outside of wedlock. So every time you're caught having an affair, you have to pay it. And then every time there's just an accusation of affair, you have to pay it. And then they get this great idea that we should put middlemen in here who come in once a year, once every 3 years, and they bid for the right to collect this insidious tax. And whoever offers to pay the English lord the most in return for the right to collect the tax, they get the job. So, of course, they put in a big bid. Yeah, we'll pay you a large sum every year for collecting this much-hated tax. But then they have to make a profit by collecting even more money in tax than they promised to pay up, right? And so they're just out there on the lookout all the time for any opportunity to be able to tax people. And when the people do pay the tax, it's way higher than the kind of marriage tax that they're paying back in England. I mean, there's a dreadful story from Blomfield and Yale in what's now Denbighshire of some men coming forward to local officials and saying, I'll tell you what, can we just reach an agreement because we can't afford to pay this tax anymore after our daughters have been accused of having boyfriends outside of marriage and we've been asked to pay this. It's breaking us. So can we reach an agreement that our daughters carry these white rods, which indicate publicly that they're prostitutes, so that therefore that we can be exempt from the possibility of you trying to collect this tax from us again. Oh, it's just dreadful. It's dreadful. I mean, that's probably the most extreme example I can think of, but that's the kind of working the system that you get from this level of administration. And that reaches a kind of apex against the backdrop of economic depression just before Glyndwr.
Yeah, an extreme example indeed. That is pretty horrible.
Pretty horrible
stuff. Yeah. So then obviously these tensions and these resentments they're bubbling, they're brewing. And so then what happens in Owain Glyndwr's revolt?
Yeah, well, Glyndwr is a funny figure, and it's hard to know how to interpret him exactly. I mean, there's a dark side to Glyndwr too, of course, right? Glyndwr declares, you know, he goes into rebellion. He's proclaimed Prince of Wales. He has vague connections with the House of de Haybarth, in particular, in South Wales. And so he has, you know, sort of royal blood in his veins, as it were. But this is a man who'd trained as a lawyer in London, who had served with the English king, who's really first falling out with the English political establishment comes when his neighbor, Reginald de Grey, Lord of the Lordship of Dufferin-Lloyd, just north of his own territory in Denbighshire, basically has a falling out with him over a bit of land and so refuses to pass on the post, which in this case is a summons to raise some men and serve the English army. And that opens up a kind of way to say, oh, no, he's a traitor because he failed to turn up and do his duty and things like this. And so it starts with that. And at the same time, that's burbling away. You have a very unpopular English king, Richard II, who's the chap who's, when he's younger, puts down the peasants' revolt in England and supposedly rides out, you know, to cut down peasants shouting, peasants ye are and peasants ye shall remain. Probably a myth, but that's the guy, right, who's a really unsavory character. And he'd gone over to Ireland in 1399, so it's just before Glyndwr, to try and put the Irish in their place. You know, it's a nice guy. And on his way back, he lands at Holyhead. He tries to come across North Wales. And eventually at Flint Castle, he's taken captive and he's deposed. Now, here you have a kind of opportunity presents itself. Because the chap who replaces him, Henry IV, the first Lancastrian king. And here's where we start thinking about the sort of Wars of the Roses, Lancastrians versus Yorkists, right? The first Lancastrian king. So Henry IV is equally really unpopular. And so the Percy family in the north of England, they say that they're going to go into rebellion and unseat this traitorous usurper. England Dorr says, here's a great opportunity. Because the Percys had some lands in North Wales, not too far from Glendora's own lands. They said, let's get together on this. And when that agreement struck, the Harry Hotspur Percy, as he's called, the kind of heir to the Percy family, a big Northumbrian family from up near Scotland, he's in Wales and he raises some troops and he goes over to confront the royal army at Shrewsbury, what would become the Battle of Shrewsbury. If that battle had been won, probably Henry IV's kingship, you know, as usurper of the English throne would have been strangled in the cradle, right? Wouldn't have, I mean, some might disagree, but I don't know, it could have come back from that blow. The problem is Hotspur, as the nickname suggests, didn't want to wait for Glendower to get his men up there so that they could do this together. And so he rides in and he's defeated at the Battle of Shrewsbury. And from that point forward, really, in practical terms, Glendower is going alone against England. And when someone says, how close does Glendower get to success? In my mind, that's it. He's done, right there, you know, at the beginning, as it were. And that's in, when is the Battle of Shrewsbury? 1403, I think, 1403 or 1404. 1403, I think. So we're right at the beginning here. And I think after that, the writing's on the wall and it's just a matter of going as long as you can, basically. But of course, Glendower, you know, he's not a real great guy. I mean, this is a guy who conducted a 10-year campaign of ethnic cleansing throughout Wales. He burned 40 of the 100 towns of Wales to the ground. Last time he was in Cardiff in 1404, he burned it to the ground, all except Greyfriars Franciscan Monastery. I mean, the rest of the town, he burned it to the ground. When I heard a few years ago that Cardiff was trying to raise money for another public statue of Glendower, I thought, well, that's grand. Last time he was there, he burned it to the ground. You know, he's not, by UN standards, by any modern estimation, like straight to the war crimes tribunal for ethnic cleansing. You know, it's the guy who spent 10 years trying to kill every Englishman in Wales. I mean, there's apologists out there, but there's not much way around that. You know, it's not a nice guy.
Yeah, a complex character, a complex history. But so what ends up happening to Glendower? And perhaps, yeah, we can touch a bit more on that legacy, how that evolves and how that's become what it is today.
Yeah, well, I mean, the short answer is we don't really know what happens to Glendower. Some French troops are invited over. He tries some international wrangling and a few French troops, you know, a couple thousand land in southwest Wales. And Glendower gets together with them and he burns Cardiff and he heads over to Woodbury Hill in Worcestershire, where there's a kind of standoff between Glendower and his French allies on one hand and the English army on the other hand. And some people say, well, you know, that's the kind of high point of the rebellion. But I think really, I mean, what happened there was they looked at each other for a couple of days and the Welsh army couldn't get any food, really. They couldn't resupply themselves. And so they just had to drift back into Wales and eventually disappear. And that's what Glendower himself does. You know, it's that kind of moment when this is it. You either go down in glory and flames or you fade away. And the army itself and Glendower, I think at that moment, you know, again, the writing was on the wall. They were going to fade away. And the fact that Glendower some years later, slips out of Harlech Castle, never to be seen again as the castle's taken. It just fits a broader pattern of, you know, bravado and a bit of hope and then just fading away rather than a blaze of glory. I mean, in practical terms, maybe he's in Mornington Straddle in Herefordshire, you know, buried in a estate where his daughter lived. That's maybe where he slipped off to. There's rumors there. Maybe he's in Kimbolton Chapel near Leinster. You know, there's lots of theories, but nobody knows. He was really effective at disappearing.
And he's become this symbol that, of, I suppose, the push for Welsh independence. I mean, how you've already mentioned the complexity of his own aims and own actions, but where does he sit in the sort of Welsh consciousness today? How is he broadly remembered?
Well, I mean, I think Today, of course, he's kind of venerated as a kind of Welsh hero. But part of that, I mean, that has, again, has much more to do with the kind of late 19th, early 20th century movement towards building Wales as a political nation, from a kind of social and cultural nation into a political nation, supported by J.E. Lloyd and others. Lloyd also wrote a biography of Glyndŵr. You know, it was part of that broader nation-building project. It's interesting when I ask undergraduate students at Swansea, you know, how do you feel about Glyndŵr? Are you interested in Glyndŵr? I teach a course on late medieval Welsh society, of course. And most of them say, no, I'm not interested. Tired of that. I've had Glyndŵr in school. Glyndŵr out the ears. Don't want to hear about Glyndŵr anymore, which surprises me. And so I think it's much more in the kind of popular history dimension where you pick up a book in a bookstore than it is in the kind of academic inquiry dimension that we find Glyndŵr living large, you know. I suppose the Yes Cymru movement's probably adopted Glyndŵr in some various ways. I don't know. Haven't checked. But I suspect he's somewhere in various chat rooms being discussed right now, but probably without the warts, as it were, rather than warts and all.
Brilliant. Right. Interesting stuff. If we can move on then, well, sort of moving on, sort of moving backwards, because you've already mentioned Henry IV, Lancastrian king, sort of sparks this conflict known as the Wars of the Roses that racks England, the region during the 15th century. How was Wales affected by the Wars of the Roses?
There's an interesting transformation that happens between Glyndŵr and the outbreak of the Wars of the Roses. I think by the time the Glyndŵr Rebellion's over, in every sense, Welsh society is exhausted. I mean, the fact that Glyndŵr burnt 40 of the roughly 100 towns of Wales, and most importantly, he burnt the biggest, most important towns, like Cardiff, means the country's in a shambles. Economically, the sort of estimated economic output of Wales, the geographical area we know as Wales today, is down 50, 60%. Doesn't recover. All of the old social bonds that held society together, I think, are very much broken. What we see is a kind of rise of a relatively small number of really rich families, what Sir Rhys Davies, the late professor of history of Oxford, called the rise of the, quote, squirearchy. And he said that rather than gentry, squirearchy, very consciously, because it calls to mind the country squire, you know, the chap who is a big fish in his own little pond, but were he across the border in England, would actually be quite poor. But that kind of generation are so keen to gobble up the property of their recently and increasingly impoverished rural Welsh neighbours. You know, I'm thinking here of the Buckleys in Anglesey, who built a big house in the middle of Beaumaris, for example. This kind of generation, that they plug themselves into that English political system. Now, that has ups and downs, right? It has ups in the sense that you can make some money, you can kind of advance socially. It has downs that when the Civil War comes, the Wars of the Roses, they're pulled right into it. And the Wars of the Roses are very much a conflict, it's not about where does Wales fit in, but rather where do these individual families fit in? And so it's quite a different situation. If you look on the internet, I don't know, if you Googled it, you'd probably find some comment like Wales was mostly Lancastrian. But that's, you know, we have two Earls of Pembroke. And these are the kind of men who influenced the future Henry, King of England, Henry VII, right? One's his uncle, Jasper Tudor, and the other is William Herbert, another man of old Welsh descent, right? One's a Lancastrian and one's a Yorkist, you know, and both of them lead Welshmen from Pembrokeshire in fighting. William Herbert, of course, is executed after military defeat in Herefordshire. And so it's hard to draw any sort of concise picture of, well, where does Wales fit in the Wars of the Roses? It's not really like that. It's more like, where does your local man climb in the greasy pole of Anglo-Welsh politics and economics fit in?
Yes, that does make an awful lot of sense. But you've already alluded to Jasper Tudor and, well, the Tudors. We've got a question from Shona, who wants very much to know about the roots of the Tudors. And I mean, it's perennially popular on our website in popular history. And yeah, people would love to know where they come from and what the Welsh roots of that family, that dynasty is.
Yeah, well, you know, there's no denying that the Tudors really do have genuine and deep Welsh roots. I've already mentioned Henry VII's uncle Jasper Tudor, who is Earl of Pembroke, and he's from an older family that goes back to Anglesey. So if we look here at Henry VII's father, Edmund Tudor, he's descended from this like Jasper, this Tudor family from Penmynydd on Anglesey. And there, the family goes all the way back to Ednyved the Khan, who was seneschal or kind of chief administrator of the Principality of Gwynedd under Llywelyn the Great back in the days of King John. So, I mean, there's a really deep family history there. And Henry VII, we don't know for sure, but he probably spoke Welsh. Probably. Again, he's raised in Anglesey, or excuse me, he's raised in Pembroke Castle mostly, by a combination at various times of his uncle Jasper Tudor, and then Jasper gets thrown out and replaced by William Herbert, who looks after him for a bit, and then later he finds himself back under the influence of his uncle Jasper Tudor again. But there's really deep Welsh connections there.
And so how does that influence his later policy when it comes to, does he have any sense of Welshness that we know about, or how does he regard himself in that way? Do we know much about that?
He certainly really plays up his Welshness. So 1485, he lands in Milford Bay in Pembrokeshire, which is a sort of landscape he's personally familiar with. And he sends riders with banners, characteristically Welsh symbolism on them, to go around Wales to try and garner support. And around 5,000 Welshmen, we think, at least 5,000 sign on to his cause and go to fight with him at Bosworth. And for a certain part of the Welsh populace, certainly the kind of more clued up in intelligentsia, the kind of poet class, they really see this as the kind of the moment when Wales goes back and conquers England. You know, after centuries of English domination, you know, when the Welsh get their own back. And that's interesting because that's very much a point of view of people in Wales. Certainly your average person on the street in England wouldn't have felt that way. But it kind of speaks to his projection of Welshness that, for example, when Henry VII moves from Wales into England, he passes through Bristol, right? Now, there are a lot of Welsh people living in Bristol. After Glendora, the economy is wrecked in Wales. And so Hereford, Bristol, Shrewsbury, Chester are just teeming with Welsh people. There's a quay in Bristol called Welsh Back, where they unload ships, you know, cargo from ships from Wales. Now, there are a lot of Welshmen living in Bristol, some one, two, three generations removed from Wales, but they round up a chap who either him or his parents are from Cardigan probably, and they immediately promote him to mayor of Bristol. So that when Henry VII, the Welsh, the new, likely Welsh king of England, trundles through, that they can wheel out a Welshman to greet him. So there's a little bit of politics play there, but it says something about his, you know, at least the perception of his connection with Wales.
Absolutely. And you mentioned that there's a possibility there that he may have spoken Welsh or some Welsh. And I wanted to ask about the impact more generally, and I realise we're talking about a huge swathe of time again here, but from conquest, from Edward I's invasion to this period now, what would that have done to Welsh culture, I suppose, particularly the Welsh language?
Well, one thinks that probably there certainly was much more mixing of, I mean, I'm going to speculate here, so take this with a pinch of salt. But one would speculate that certainly after the so-called final conquest, the 1280s, that there's more mixing of people in Wales, in the sense that we no longer have this two-speed society. So all of Wales has now been conquered. And in the years immediately after the English conquest of Wales, thousands and thousands of young men are recruited from Wales to go fight in the English army in Scotland. And I did some work on the kind of numbers from the muster rolls, because we have really detailed lists of exactly who signed up and who collected their weekly pay. You know, English administration all the way back to the Middle Ages is nothing if not a penny counting machine. It's just amazing attention to detail in these things. And in terms of fighting age men, in the first couple of decades after the conquest of Wales, maybe 25% of fighting age men at some point served in the English army. And these are people coming from all over Wales because the economy's, you know, in the doldrums, and there's not much aspiration. There's no outlet for sort of, the kind of constant crisis we have of sort of particularly young male people in society feel they need to do something. You know, we try to get people involved in, you know, sport clubs and any kind of outlet for this you know, some would say it toxic masculinity, one might even argue, right? But, you know, whacking yourself into the army, that's been around a long time. You know, you can imagine the kind of recruiting videos we have now. You know, come have an adventure. Well, some of that mentality has been there right back in the Middle Ages. But people mixed from all different parts of Wales. And the same thing would have happened during the course of fighting in the Hundred Years' War between England and France. There are always Welsh soldiers involved there. But certainly trade with the creation of a string of English towns in Wales, it gets all joined up to some degree between England and Wales, and people are moving around. And we see a new generation of poets, of course, but we kind of think of these two men as sort of opposite ends of the spectrum. So you have, on the one hand, Gruffydd Ab Erined Coch, so the sort of Gruffydd, the son of the Red Judge, who is a poet in the time of Llywelyn the Last, and he writes, you know, famously when Llywelyn's killed. So, oh, you know, the sky is falling, you know, the world has ended, you know, but really that was a class of poets who were out there trying to earn their dinner by impressing a very narrow cadre of aristocratic Welsh people. On the other end, you get a kind of much more low down, I don't know, grittier level of kind of poet comes afterwards here. So I'm Dafydd Ap Gwilym, I'm thinking about here in the 14th century, who writes great poems about things like staying in an inn overnight, and he tries some wine, he's never had it before, and so he gets a full gallon. He says, "Oh, terrible mistake!" You know, you know, and these are people who are really, anybody who has a little bit of money to patronize them, they're happy to perform to, and that kind of more connected with the people, kind of almost. I'm trying to avoid using the phrase democratization of culture, but that conveys the sense of what I mean, that things becoming more ordinary, more accessible in a way. That happens. And it's interesting that right at the end of the Middle Ages, the kind of second sort of bookend of, if you would, is Gutter Glyn. So what you have is Gutter Glyn is one of his most important patrons is William Herbert. So William Herbert is a son of the man who built Raglan Castle in the South Wales. He's an old Welsh family. And of course, he's fighting in the Wars of the Roses, right? And eventually, Gutter Glyn sort of follows him around and writes various poems. And he now represents the establishment from the other end. He is part of this kind of, at that point, pan-Welsh-English political establishment, fighting in an English civil war. How far removed can you get from following around the Prince of Wales in his conflict with the English? Here is William Herbert's a man who's in that system. He's fundamental to that system, right? And of course, he dies. And at that point, rather than this is the end of the world, Gutter Glyn produces a eulogy where he calls it a dance of death. You know, William Herbert has died in the dance of death, the dance of bulls, right? Rather than the end of the world, nope, this just happens. This is how it is. We play this game, you know. And I like those two kind of perspectives, this kind of bookends in the period. But culture changes fast. You know, I mean, certainly compare social attitudes now to just 40 years ago. You know, I mean, culture changes really fast.
Absolutely. And we've chosen to sort of bookend this episode, this chat, with a listener question on, so this is Minnie Fay on the Laws in Wales Acts 1532 and 1542. What did they mean for Wales?
Relief. I think for most, relief. The 1536, I'm trying to think what it's officially called there, is the Act, you know, we call it the Act of Union usually, but it's officially it's something like the Act for Laws and Justice to be ministered in Wales in like form as it is in England, something like that. And it meant just what it said on the tin. So these kind of discriminatory race laws that start probably back in 1067, but really get formalized and embedded in the late 13th century, when even the Crown in 1295 is rolling them out. You know, Welshmen may not do this. Welshmen may not testify against an Englishman in court. Welshmen may not sell their property without, you know, without royal permission. But Welshmen cannot do whatever, right? That's percolating away in the background the whole time. And that gets just totally intertwined with the chronic mismanagement in Wales. And small towns in particular, where they are dominated by English townsmen, a whole wave of them set out to get new town charters banning Welsh people from living in those towns. You know, just imagine that now, you know. The sort of town elders getting together and saying, well, let's just get from the king a new charter saying that the Welshmen can't live here and we can just confiscate all their property arbitrarily. And that's going on right into the 1400s. And Llandovery is one of the last, you know, in the mid-1400s, they got a charter and it says, you know, if any Welshman buys property here, we should have the right to be able to confiscate it and give it to the king. That's still going on. You know, every time you feel the pinch economically, particularly in an urban setting, the English minority use that as an opportunity very often, you know, to in some way kind of one-up their Welsh neighbors. You know what I mean? It's just kind of really, I mean, it's systemic racism in every possible sense of the word, you know, economically, socially, culturally, it's there. And yes, you have these great stories, like there's a Welshman who helps defend Brecon against Glyndwr, and he's later honored by a plaque in the city. Great, that happens. But you know what else happens? It's Llandovery a few miles away. He knocks out a new charter that allows them to basically steal all of their Welsh neighbors' property because they can. And that all ends in 1536. And there's a really good anecdote, and I'm trying to remember which town it said, and I think it's in Carnarvon in North Wales, because Carnarvon is the royal capital for administering North Wales, where when the act is read out, a short while later, a bunch of Welshmen ride into town on horses, waving swords, which would have been illegal under the previous ordinances for Welshmen to be armed in town. They ride in, they ride around, shouting, "Now we're as good as you are." You know, and so that it's a moment of relief. You know, Henry VII has come to the throne, and there are all kinds of other chronic endemic problems with crime in Wales. Wales is all carved up into little administrative units. Somebody commits a serious crime in one, like murder, or even trafficking. There's traffic, we know of examples, there's trafficking of young women to be sold into slavery in brothels between one lordship and another. Even though it's only a few miles to the next administrative district owned by the next English marcher lord, you can't do anything about it. You know, you can't prosecute this. People selling pardons for cash, for people living in, you know, who've committed a crime in the county next door. It's really common, you know. And all of those problems, they're not stopped, but legally a framework is created to stop them with the Act of Union. Now we think of the Act of Union as a kind of, I think popularly as some kind of tragedy which robbed Wales of its separateness. But the reality is Wales was a checkerboard of usually disastrously run little micro kingdoms with each one had their own little system of systemic anti-Welsh racism, and all of that's just blotted out at a stroke.
I think that's a really interesting point. I think when I spoke with Martin Johns a while back about modern Wales, he mentioned this as a sort of perhaps a turning point where Wales in many occasions started leaning into points of difference with England in order to sort of differentiate themselves. But there was also this phenomenon of this real embrace of England, English culture, because they were on this equal footing. And that's the phenomenon you're talking about here.
Yeah, there's a weird kind of interaction happened. So some of these families, like the Herberts or the Stradlings or other families in South Wales, they really have become embedded in this sort of emergent, I think for the first time we could use in a political sense the word kind of British sort of culture. And in fact, in this period after the Act of Union, Wales becomes, in a way, not a tourist destination, but almost fashionable to have some British connection, but British in the sense of this older, deeper culture of the British Isles. No aristocrat broke up in London and said, "Oh, I wish I'm Welsh." But on the other hand, you could lean into your own culture a little bit. You didn't have to, if you're from South Wales, you no longer had to pretend to be, you know, to kind of pretend to be English to your English friends, Welsh to your Welsh friends. You know, now you can kind of lean into the Britishness. And of course, this older word Briton refers to people speaking the old Brittonic language, with the language that would evolve into Welsh and evolve into Cornish and evolve into Breton. And it's a language and culture that existed in Britain before the invasion of Anglo-Saxons and Jutes after the Romans left. You know, that those other peoples that turned England into a place where they spoke English, another language.
Interesting. Okay, well, I think very sadly we'll have to begin to wrap up this episode. But if I can ask you, Matthew, for any sort of other resources or places where people can go to find out more about Welsh history, particularly in this period, where would you point our listeners to?
I mean, the standard history of Wales that everybody should pick up at some point is still John Davis's History of Wales. For all its faults, it's a good read. And it's full of great little anecdotes. You know, St. David, for example, creates a miracle at Llandwy Brefi, where supposedly he raises a hill underneath him as he's speaking about God and Jesus. And of course, the great quote about that in his book is, "What more superfluous miracle did you need in Llandwy Brefi than an extra hill?" But if you're interested in more detail, certainly the types of social and cultural issues I'm interested in. I mean, you could have a look at my book, The Economy of Wales, 1067 to 1536, with the University of Wales Press, which is not just about the economy, but about the whole society that underpinned it and how it changed throughout this period. It's only about 150 pages. It's meant for a general clued up audience to be able to pick it up and enjoy it. And if you're interested in more detail on some of these topics, you can have a look at my podcast, History, Darkness and Light, where the second episode is all about the history of race and race law in medieval Wales.
That was Matthew Stevens. You can find out more about the history of Wales on our website at historyextra.com/location/Wales. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.